Psalm 133, let's read it from verse 1. It's only three verses, so it's a nice and short one here this morning. Doesn't mean my message will be short, just means the psalm is short. It says, "Behold, how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. It is like the precious oil on the head running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the collar of his robes. It is like the dew of Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord has commanded the blessing, life forevermore." So we're going to talk about this idea of unity here this morning, which is so important within the church. And as we read the New Testament, there are some obvious threads that we see, especially beyond the Gospels in the formation of the early church, some obvious threads that are being woven by the writers of the New Testament. And one of these key threads is unity. And the Apostle Paul is harping on about this time and time again throughout the New Testament, the need for unity. And what we see and what Paul and other writers draw our attention to is the continual disunity that's taking place within the body of Christ, and Paul continually bringing correction to that. But in this psalm, it talks about unity as something beautiful, something precious, something that creates a feeling, an atmosphere when we are in it and we see it happening and we feel it happening and we are experiencing it within the church. God has called us to unity in his body. So let's have a look at this. A few kind of key words I just want to draw our focus to here this morning. One is when it says brothers dwell in unity. Why this word in particular? Why brothers? Is this simply just speaking to men, or is there something more here? So we're going to look at brothers dwell. We're going to look at it is like precious oil. Why precious oil? And the dew of Hermon. What on earth is David singing about? So let's look at brothers dwell. Now, when we read this word brother in the Bible, it's often translated from a word that means brethren or kindred. It's this family word. And there is a masculine component to this, even within this context. But broadly speaking, this word brothers, we could also use the word family. We can use the word kindred. But there is a significant importance of the masculine version of this word when it's talking about brothers, because in this context, when David wrote this psalm, there was a very important and specific role that men played in Israel. Men were the warriors. Men were the soldiers. Men were the farmers. Men were the priests. Men were the kings. Men had a special divine calling and responsibility on their lives. And we see from the Old Testament, when the priests neglected their function and when they were in disunity, when the soldiers were in disunity, when the palace was in disunity, the whole nation became disunified. There was dysfunction that flowed down from that disunity of the specific roles that men had been called to. But we can also broaden this, obviously, to women, even in this older context as well. An example, we have King David. We read about David and his mighty men. And as we read the story of David forming this group of soldiers called the mighty men, they were unified. They were harmonized in one spirit. They had this closeness with each other. They had this kindred-like bond, this relationship, this this beautiful, harmonious relationship with each other, and it made them unstoppable. Remember when Saul, who was king at the time, was jealous because they would sing about Saul and how he would slay the enemy in their thousands, but David in the tens of thousands, because David was able to accomplish this great feat because of this unified team he had around him. But we also see the picture when David became disunified, when he became disconnected from his kindred, from his brethren. And that results in things like what happened with Bathsheba and Uriah. David was supposed to be at battle. David was supposed to be with the armies. David was supposed to be in unity, but he wasn't. He withdrew and he was in the palace alone. He was by himself on the rooftop. And that's when he lost the strength to resist temptation. That's when he lost the strength to operate as a man of God, because he had disconnected himself from his kindred, from his brethren. He became disunified. So, when there is unity, there is strength. When there is unity, we win. The church advances. When there is disunity, there is dysfunction. And this psalm speaks directly into this, and the Apostle Paul echoes this again and again and again in the New Testament. And not just in the New Testament as we read within its pages, but as we look over church history. The dysfunction we see in the church is because of the disunity in the church. It is a major problem. But it's both broad and it's both local. And we need to make sure that on a local level, we are unified. So it talks about this unity like precious oil running like on the head and running on the beard of Aaron and running onto his collar. Like, what is this? Because I don't know about you, but oil dripping over my head and my beard and on my clothes doesn't sound nice. Like, that just sounds like a lot of work trying to get that oil out of my clothing. Well, it's like Creone getting that oil out of my clothing. There probably should be me more, but Creone is somehow just better at washing than me. But like, it's a weird expression, right? And obviously it's an ancient expression. Like if I tipped oil on your head to me and it just ran, no, you don't have a beard, so that's not going to work. Like Matt, if I tipped oil on your head and it ran into your beard and like getting oil in your eyes, you're not thinking of how precious is this? Like this is what unity feels like. It's like, really? Is this what unity feels like? Because this is weird. A few different things. First of all, we have to understand it uses this word precious. This isn't just like going in the cupboard and getting out olive oil and tipping it over Matt Blair's head. Although there was like olive oil was in there, but this was a concoction of spices that created this beautiful aroma. Did you know, even God in the law instructed Israel exactly what spices and how much were to go into this oil? We can read it in Exodus chapter 30 from verses 22. We won't put it up on the screen, but it's got myrrh, it's got cinnamon, it's got aromatic cane, it's got cassia bark. I have no idea what that is, but I'm sure it smells wonderful. It's got olive oil as well, but it's got these spices. So we have to understand this. And it talks about in the law here how much money they're meant to invest into each one of these spices to create this oil. And it's an extraordinary amount of money that it costs them to make this oil. So it's expensive oil and it smells incredible. Like it was the most incredible smell that there was. Like, remember, like there's no Ralph Lauren back in those days. There's no Armani. There's no like that. They haven't, like, those European perfume companies had not been created yet. This was the pinnacle of perfumes. It smelt incredible. And even the very picture of this oil that they would pour, there is an exactness to how they were to make this oil. And the combination of this cinnamon and the combination of this myrrh and a combination of this acacia bark and the combination of whatever that other substance was that I read before, like there is a unity even within the oil. And when this unity took place in the oil, it resulted as a fragrance that was beautiful. And almost the same as within the church, like before we get to oil on the head and the beard and the collar, like just the oil itself, David is singing about even just this precious oil and the smell it creates. It is the same within the church. It's the same within our family. It's the same within smaller settings or larger settings. When there is unity, it creates a fragrance that becomes so overpowering that all of the other smells start to disappear. And we have to understand that this is in a time and in a culture where they probably stunk. Like there was no deodorant. Like maybe, I don't know, they rubbed salt or something under there. I don't know what they did back then, but they didn't shower every day. Like they probably didn't even shower once. Like to bathe, they probably went to the Jordan River or something. Like in the wilderness, like the British, is it? Okay. He's saying the British smell. Like the Indians. Oh my gosh. Okay. We're just like culturally stereotyping here now. But like they probably stunk, right? They like, if like the, if you're standing, like these men came back from battle or like from the farming field, like they probably hadn't had a bath in like weeks. They absolutely just stunk. And so like it's talking about this oil, and they used this oil to anoint the priest, which thank goodness, because like you went to the priest for like for prayer, and if they didn't have the oil, like it was the first time that they had like the falling over in the spirit, but it was really from just the bad BO. It was like, you know, they'll get prayers, overwhelmed by the stench, but this oil made up for that stench. Like it would have smelled incredible coming to the temple. They used this oil to coat all the instruments within the temple, so the temple smelt amazing. You would have smelt the temple from outside the temple. I wonder if people can smell the unity of the church outside of the church. Unfortunately, it's not always the case. Unfortunately, sometimes the world smells something else. So it smelt amazing. This oil had a significant ritualistic component. What the oil touched became holy. In other words, you couldn't go into the temple without having this oil on you. The priests had to be coated in this oil. The instruments, the menorah, the table, like the different objects in the temple had to have this oil in it. Otherwise, it was deemed unholy. Unity is like being completely holy before God. Unity is like being the cleanest you could ever be. This oil makes things holy. The Jew of Hermon. So it says unity is like this precious oil, and on the head and the beard and the collar of Aaron. And again, the significance of that is because this oil causes a person to be holy. Now remember, just before we get onto the Jew of Hermon, in this old covenantal state that Israel was in, only the priest could become holy by this oil and enter the temple. But we have all been made holy. We all get to live in the temple. But this psalmist is almost saying, when there is disunity, it causes an unholiness within the temple. So God is calling us into holiness, and part of that holiness is to be unified. And we'll talk about at the end what this unity actually looks like. But then it says the Jew of Hermon. Hermon was is the highest mountain in Israel. And it's at the north of Israel. And then it talks about this dew of Hermon basically watering the mountains of Zion, Zion being Jerusalem in the south. And so it's got this idea of saying unity is like this dew, this moisture that waters the lands of God. And the most fertile desert in the world, or one of the most fertile deserts in the world, is the Atacama Desert. The Atacama Desert is also the desert with the least amount of rainfall. There is significant parts of the Atacama Desert that has not seen rain in over 100 years. But yet this desert is incredibly fertile. There is a lot of wildlife that live in this desert because this desert borders the ocean, and this mist comes through every morning. And with this mist, as the temperature warms up, it leaves this blanket of dew on the ground of the Atacama Desert, producing fertility so that plants can grow, so that animals have food. So there's this idea in this song that David has written talking about unity within the kindred, within the family of God. It's like a dew that waters the land. Zion is where we live. We live on the mountain of God. We live in God's presence. Whether we can feel God's presence or not, we live in God's presence. And unity is like a dew that waters the ground in which we live. Where there is unity, there is fertility. Where there is unity, things grow. The church will become healthy when we are unified. So, what do we need to do to be unified? How do we function? How do we need to live? Well, I wanted to keep this real simple. And I just want to talk about one perspective that we can have. Just one thought that I believe if we allow this thought to unfold in our minds and work out what it looks like for us, we can increase the unity within the church. And I will say, I'm preaching to the choir here. I would say, as a church, we are a beautiful family. There's always little moments of disunity that we can have, but we have a beautiful family here at Lighthouse Springfield. I would say we're incredibly unified, but there's always work that we can do. And I'm sure there is people within the church who maybe don't feel or aren't experiencing that unity. So what we need to do, those of us who feel the unity, we need to work out how do we extend this unity. Because unity isn't just being amicable. Unity isn't just trying to get along with people. Unity isn't just simply not trying to cause an argument. Unity is to bring people into the family. Unity is to feel like we are part of the family of God. And I think sometimes where there is disunity is when a group or a person doesn't feel like that they're part of that family. So here's the one perspective that I would love all of us to have. How do we see this type of unity where it's like precious oil? You just flicked me with your water. Did you see that? How do we... that's just sharing. Sharing is caring, right? The oil. Yeah, that was just the oil of unity. The precious oil running onto my collar. Down my beard. How do we have this sort of unity where it's like this dew that makes the land fertile, where it's like this beautiful smelling fragrance and aroma? How do we have it? Here's the perspective that we all need to have. Repeat after me, actually. Say, I am the church. for true unity to exist, we need to stop seeing the church as an organization. And I think this is a major problem within the church, that too many Christians view the church as an organization. Now, there's an organizational aspect, obviously, to the church, but that's a function of the church. The church can function organizationally, but the church is not an organization. The church is a family. Cree and I were on holidays over January, and when we're on holidays, we tend to not go to church on a Sunday. We just spend time with family, and mainly because when we visit another church, like, I can't turn my brain off. Like, I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that, I'm like going, oh, maybe that could be better, or like, I cannot switch my brain off. But we thought, it was the first Sunday in January. You guys didn't have a service. It was on the 5th of January. So while you guys were all chilling out, we thought, we'll go to church and let's visit a church we've never been to. And there happened to be a church just a block away from where we were staying. And it was a lovely service. But when we arrived at the church, it was just this hilarious kind of moment that we had. And so we went up to the front door, and there was a guy standing at the front door. So naturally, I went up to him and said, "Hey mate, how you doing?" And I shook his hand. Get this was just awesome. This was amazing. He said to me, "Oh, I'm not on the welcome team." I just saw so good. No, you're not. No, you are not. I feel like saying, yes, you are. It's this mentality that we can get it, because the thing is, he is on the welcome team. Like, what on earth is the welcome? Like, just the concept of a welcome team is so silly anyway. I know we have welcome teams at church, but in a way, they are kind of dumb. Like, it's just weird that we have a welcome team, right? Because really, like, we all are on the welcome team, because we are all the church. The church is not a service. The church is not departments. The church is not a structure. The church is not rosters. The church has these things, but the church is not these things. But I find for so many Christians, they are trapped in this cultural Christianity rather than a true Christianity or a biblical Christianity. Because a cultural Christianity builds within us a picture of what the church should look like rather than what I look like as the church. And so we place this projection over the church that we think it should be, of what we think it should do, or how it should behave. And we kind of fall into this mode of, and we have this thinking, and I know we use this language, and I don't like this language, but we use it, I'm going to church. Like, that is impossible. Like, you can't, it's physically not possible to go to church, because there is no to church to go to. Like, we can gather as the church, but we can't go to church. And I understand what we're saying, because like, when we use that phrase, it's okay to use that phrase, because we're saying we're going to the geographical location, the building where the church gathers. So I understand what we are saying. And it's weird when we say, oh, we're going to the YMCA. Like, that sounds weird, right? Like, we're going to the sports and the community center. Like, it just, no one knows what you're talking about. What, you're playing badminton? So I understand why we say we're going to church, but a far more biblically accurate phrase is to say we're gathering with the church, because I am the church. I am a piece of the church. I am a living stone, as the Apostle Peter talks about, and I'm going to be with the other living stones so that when we gather, we become the temple of God. Let's read that passage right now. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4. As you come to him, a living stone, rejected by the world, rejected by men, but in the sight of God, chosen and precious. You yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. We start to see this language of unity that David used in the Psalms, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And if we buzz down to verse 9, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. The church doesn't have a couple of priests. The church is priests. We are all priests. We are part of the priesthood. We all have that same oil that was poured upon Aaron on us. It's amazing when, like, sometimes when visitors come to our service, like last year we changed up our formatting a little bit, and instead of starting worship at 9 o'clock, we have a community time from 9 o'clock, and worship starts at 9:30. I know some of you guys forget about it, but we do start at 9 o'clock. But because there is an important point to that community time, because in that community time is unity time. Because sometimes when we're in the service and we're sitting looking at the front, we're not looking at each other, we're not engaging with each other. And so we really build community actually in the unity time. And we could argue to a degree when there's preaching and worship, where we sing and praise, like there's unity taking place in this room as well, but there's real unity taking place out there. So that's why we made that little shift. But when a visitor comes and they walk in and the visit, this is a good reason to get here at 9 a.m. because visitors are the people who get there early. Like for some reason, visitors are the first people on the premises for some reason. Like they get here real early. So the more of us are here, the better. It's way easier. And but when they come, there's this expectation that at 9 a.m. we should sing songs, right? Because there's this cultural Christianity that's taken over our thinking, and there's a certain format. Okay, I go to church. I get the service chance at 9 o'clock. So I get there, I walk in the door, I find my seat, I sing some songs, I listen to some notices, I hear some preaching, someone might tell a story, we go out, I have my coffee, I leave. Like it's like this, and that's what church is, but that is not what church is. Like that's what we do. Like that's kind of like, there's a structural component to just the church local community. We do those things, but that's not the church. And so when visitors come for the first time, they're often taken back when we say, oh, there's a bit of community time at the start. It's like, what? Like, there's supposed to be worship at the start. There's supposed to be worship, and then there's announcements, and then there's preaching. Like, that's what's supposed to happen, right? And so it throws them. And I kind of like the idea of throwing people a little bit. But we've also got to throw our, like, we've got to see the valuableness of that time. But not just the valuableness of that time, you've got to see the valuableness of you being here as the church for that time, because we are all on the welcome team. Don't see the church as an institution that serves you. Did you know the New Testament teaches that your calling is to serve the church? The church doesn't serve you. You serve the church. But there is a symbiotic relationship. When we all serve the church, we end up serving each other. So we're not served by the church. We're served by Yazzie, or we're served by Joe, or we're served by Grant or Angela or whoever it is. So when the church serves us, we're actually serving each other. And that's how it is meant to work. So when we're here on a Sunday and we're out in the foyer and we're mingling, forget about teams, forget about structure, just be welcoming. Be kind. Look out for people standing alone. And I know this is how, like, some of us are more extrovert. Like, I've had to learn to be an extrovert over my time. It means we've got to get uncomfortable. But guess what? Serving is uncomfortable. Being part of the church is uncomfortable. God wants to get you out of your comfort zone. God wants to push you, like a father would push their children in a good way, because it's good for them. So look out for people standing alone. When we were at this church, like after the service, like the first thing I wanted to do is just go up and talk to someone. Like I'm like, because I don't like that awkwardness. And it was one of the few times that I got to experience what it was like being a new person to a church. And Kree and I were standing, so I'm like, all right, I'm going to find someone. I'll go to that person. I'm going to just go. Well, that's what Grant Carla would do as well. But Kree said, no, let's just wait. Let's just stand here. I'm like, we're not meant to stand here. But Kree's like, no, let's just see what it's like. I hated it. Like, it was terrible. Like, it was just awkward. Like, I'm just like, where do you look? It's like, oh, that person looked at me. Oh, I can't. I'm staring. I'm like, oh, this is a nice building. Like, I like what they've done with the roof. Like, that's what I've got to look at, because it's just so awkward, right? Because, like, you look at someone, they look at you, and no one moves. And it's just, I do not like it. Like, it's the most uncomfortable thing. And there are extreme introverts that'll be way more uncomfortable than I was. But I was super uncomfortable. I did not like it. And so it just reminded me of the importance of all of us. And this is what unity is, because I know we can get in our conversations and that's good. And we can still have our conversations and we can still pray for one another and we can still give each one another attention and listen. But let's just have our eyes open. Let's just be aware. Is there someone alone? Is there someone that seems awkward? Is there someone not talking to someone else? And we don't necessarily have to leave our conversation, but bring them in, because this unity is like the brothers dwell in unity. This word dwell is to inhabit, is to abide. So this dwelling is a closeness. So unity is a dwelling. It's a coming together. It's having an open door, an open heart, and it's allowing people in. So come early, stay back a little late, and let's be the church. And one of the primary functions we can do as the church is to have our eyes and our hearts open to other people. And let's have our arms out, metaphorically or sometimes physically, and let's bring people in. Let's bring them into our conversations. Let's bring them into our little world. Let's meet other people up. Like, you know, we get to, like, find out what people like. Find out their story. And the more stories you find out, it's like, Andrew's got a similar story. I'm going to bring you over with it. Hey, Andrew, have you met this person? Da, 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 da. And we can help connect people together. We don't need a welcome roster. It's all of us. Like, get someone's details. Contact them during the week. Ask what they like to do. Maybe you might discover that there's three people you've talked to and they all like knitting. Hey, let's get together and start to knit. Oh, don't I need permission? From who? Like, you're part of the priesthood. Like, you are the church. Like, if you like to do something, like, just get together and do it. Like, find out what people like and get together and do those things. Start knitting, start fishing, start baking, start gardening, whatever it is. Like, what do you like to do? What do they like to do? And just think of, I am the church. We are the church. We are a kindred. We are a family. How do I strengthen that family bond? Unity is to strengthen the family bond. You are a priest. Let's stand to our feet. We all know what it's like. Well, some of us might know what it's like to have dysfunction in the family. Some of us more than others. Some of us know what it's like to have harmony in the family. When there's harmony in the family, in other words, and not just in our immediate family, but in our extended family. Like, think of Christmas, right? Which wasn't that long ago. Some people love Christmas and some people don't love Christmas. Often the people who don't love Christmas is because there's dysfunction in the family. And Christmas is in that time, is that petri dish where that dysfunction can be highlighted. But Christmas time for us, like, we're blessed to have incredible families. I love Christmas Day. I love being with family, or Boxing Day, or Christmas Eve, or whatever it is. I just love being with family and sitting around and eating and talking and just being in each other's presence. Like, when family is working, it's life-giving. It's beautiful. When family isn't working, it's life-draining. It's sucking. It's depleting. We need to go on a vacation after family time to re-energize ourselves. God wants his church, broadly speaking, but let's just think of it in this local context, to not be the dysfunctional family. He wants this to be the life-giving family, where we can come and be with the family and we can let our guards down. We can just relax. We can just talk. We can eat, not worried about the food that's on our face that we don't realize. Just be in each other's presence. It's life-giving. It's energizing. It's refreshing. That's what God wants the church to be. That's why David attributes unity to, like, this beautiful, fragrant oil that makes everything smell amazing. And this dew that causes the ground to be fertile and for plants to grow and it to be rich in vegetation. That is the biblical vision of the church. And my hope is that becomes our vision for the church.